cable television. More information is available at www.ct.gov/occ or at 860-827-2900.
United Way is committed to ensure the financial stability of every person in Connecticut. Nearly half of Americans are financially fragile, meaning too many have too little in savings to cover the basics. United Way is providing the Saver Life program, which is a nationwide matched savings program, and the Trusted Advisor program, which offers free budget coaching. More information about these programs is at alice.ctunitedway.org.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, serving communities in Fairfield, New Haven, Litchfield, and Suffolk counties, and streaming to the world at WPKN.org.
Michelle Bollier Morgan. Did I say that right?
That's correct. Okay. The totally butchered Anglo version of Bollier.
Who is an artist whose embroidered work is featured on the new Kebmo album that comes out June 14th. So that will be happening soon. We're taping this earlier and broadcasting it later. So by the time you hear this, it will be out. And you are also having a show in the fall at the Whitney Humanities Center.
Yes, that's right. The album comes out on June 14th, which will be my 40th birthday in the past at this point.
Fantastic. So that's a good benchmark to reach for your 40th, a major album cover and an exhibit.
Yes, it is. The show isn't until the fall, but it's been about 2 years in the planning, so I feel like I'm definitely ready for that to happen.
Wow, 2 years in the planning because the Whitney Humanities Center
is just booked up all the time. Yeah, they plan their exhibitions out quite a distance.
Yeah. So the show is called Material Obsessions, and what can we expect?
Sure. So I was writing a dissertation a few years ago. I was a grad student at Yale in American Studies, and I focused on visual and material culture. And I wrote a dissertation around the ways materials in the 19th century helped people think about themselves as subjects and their bodies and what it means to actually be human or inhuman or animate or inanimate. And the name of the dissertation was Material Possessions, to signify the ways that materials really possess us. I'm interested in that concept as an artist and as a scholar. And so the exhibition itself that I'll be doing this fall is a body of work that's my embroidery work. And it came out of this real sort of divide that happened when I was in graduate school between like writing this very scholarly academic dissertation that was using one part of my brain and then really not being able to spend any time making things anymore. So I'm writing about people who make things all the time, but I'm not actually doing that work myself.
What were you making before this?
So, gosh, when I was, I mean, for like a deep history, when I was a teenager, I thought about going to art school, and then I went to college and was majoring in humanities broadly and had a baby when I was 20. I got pregnant when I was 19, when I was in college, and really wanted to go to art school. Never went to art school, always just kept to the academic side of things. And I, regardless, would do mixed media things in my basement. I was always making stuff, a lot of cut paper, a lot of like really intricate collages. And I did that for years and years and years, right through college. After college, I was a bartender, and I worked in an eating disorder clinic, and I was still making mixed media and collage.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I applied to grad school, I kind of decided that I needed to just give it up because I wasn't going to have time to do both. I had this sense that I would come to New Haven, and I'd come to Yale, and there was going to be no time for that. And just to have that stuff even hanging around.
Why would you want to cut that part of yourself off? That's shocking to me that you would come up with a set of rules like that. You know, it's sort of like some sort of weird orthorexia, speaking of
eating disorders. It's perfect, right? It is actually exactly why we're calling this material obsession. So yeah. I did cut it off. I just decided that, like, the only way I was going to be successful is if I went all in on the PhD. I had no models for this. I'm a first generation.
But it is true that you do want to concentrate on it, and you really want to give yourself all to that, but you also need some time to... One of the things that art making, everybody who listens to the show probably makes things and knows this, but it allows you to think through things and process information.
I don't know.
So it could, in fact, be quite helpful to you, too.
Well, it was damaging not to, which is why I got really, really depressed in grad school. Mm-hmm. And I have zero doubts that part of this massive depression that I suffered in graduate school was because I wasn't making things. And so when I picked up embroidery, it was 4 years ago, I basically had given up on finishing my PhD.
Mm-hmm. And was that ever finished? Did you?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
yeah,
it is. Okay.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
No, it's okay. So I had decided that I was not going to be able to finish. I was really depressed. I read this book by Anne Kvetkovich. I can never say her name without stumbling on it. It's called Depression, A Public Feeling, and she writes about the process of being in school or being an academic and also suffering from, like, depression if she's not making things, and really using crafting and art making as a way through that process. And I read that book, decided that I had to be making something, and sort of stumbled upon embroidery and became really obsessed with it in the same way that I am obsessions with other things over the course of my life.
And did you choose it partly because of these Victorians?
No, I really did just stumble on it. My friend bought me a little cross-stitch kit and put it in my Christmas stocking as a joke. It was like one of those subversive cross-stitch, and it said, like, bite me or something. Uh-huh. And I sat there and I, like, maniacally made it over the course of a couple hours. And then I started looking at things online and saw some embroidery work, and I was like, I could do that.
Yeah.
And so I picked it up and then became equally obsessed with that. But it did give me a breakthrough, and it did allow me to, like, suddenly the depression was partially, like, lots of reasons why I got better, quote unquote. But really making things again was integral to my finishing my dissertation and, like, just being happy again. So,
and what happens when you make things? So for me, I feel like I think through things better when I'm touching things.
Yes.
So this is one of the reasons why I like books better than, say, e-readers.
Yeah.
I like to touch the book, hold the book.
I think, like, just keeping my hands busy in general is something
that allows your brain to do something else.
Yeah. And of course, anytime you make art, you're not really in the same sphere. Like, it allows you to go somewhere else. I feel like I experience time differently in a way that also happens when I'm writing. Like, if I'm really into whatever I'm working on, you know, that kind of focus happens across medium, whether you're an artist or a musician or a writer. But for me, it's something to do with keeping my hands busy.
Mm-hmm. Although if you were typing, you could be keeping your hands busy. It's just not.
Yeah.
It's, for me, it doesn't feel as satisfying to work on a computer screen.
No. It doesn't. It's still, typing is text, and I think it has something to do with me for it being like a non-textual element versus using the verbal side of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So making things without it being textual is what's, even though I use text in my embroideries frequently, but that's really important to me. And it's still tied to what I wrote about. Like, how do people understand the world when they're not using language to make sense of it?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I think you can be pre-language or post-language or outside of language, but you can be adjacent to it. So, so Material Obsessions came out of that. Like, it's a play on the dissertation title, but also about my own sort of obsession with materials, period.
Right, so you're working with textiles, and which feel nice, and also come in these great colors. Embroidery floss comes in just a dazzling rainbow, and it's usually this beautiful shiny cotton, sometimes silk. Let's start with the album cover, how that happened. And because it's radio, try to describe what it looks like. People can look at it. You can go on to there are many Kevmo websites that people can go on and look at. And the album is called Oklahoma.
Yes. So the album cover came sort of out of the sky. I had done a piece on Instagram that was a digital community-ish project. Part of me not finishing my dissertation for so long and then becoming really, really focused on making embroidery pieces took up all the shame I had about not being able to finish projects or like jumping ship.
No follow through. Yeah, my big, really hard like, to follow I hammer myself for no follow through all the time.
So I had made this giant piece because I had decided, okay, never again am I going to cut art out of my life like that. Mm-hmm. I need to force myself to make time for it every day, no matter what. So I started this big piece that was a one a day stitch along. So this is how I kind of got like a little viral on Instagram, where I would ask people over the internet, give me a suggestion for something to add to this piece. So every single day for an entire year, I added a element.
What do you mean by an element?
Like an image? A taco or a flamingo or like a picture of something. A feeling even. Or I would like illustrate through embroidery that feeling.
And how did you pick which one?
So people would comment a ton and I would count how many people had commented. And then I would use a random number generator, like 1 through 35. And it would spit out a number and I would count down and that's the one I would add for that day. And I would tag the person. And it sort of grew into this large thing. And it was really cool when it was done, and a lot of people really liked it. I sold it to a woman who lives in Canada.
How big was it?
It was like, I don't know, 14-inch round hoop. It was a large, like, quilting hoop.
So the defining feature of some of your embroidery is that they take the shape of the hoop.
Yes. Usually use the hoop as a frame for, right. Which is a whole other thing.
So you're dealing with circles.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
are there pictures of this online still?
There are. Yeah, okay. Definitely. On my Instagram, which is Mutually Assured Deconstruction, all one word, which I came up with before people knew who I was and now feel stuck with because that's how people know me. This woman had seen this piece and was interested in doing something similar for the Keb Mo album. She was knew she wanted something embroidered, went on Instagram, and I came up in her searches around embroidery.
Right. So and when you say it went viral, what does that mean?
So my son, who will be 20 in December at the time, this was 3 years ago, I guess, was just like kind of laughing at me like, you post this stuff on Instagram, you're an embroiderer, you're a nerd mom, blah, blah, blah. And then like had to eat his words because suddenly people were sharing it and
People were sharing it?
Well, it's up to almost 25,000 people.
Wow. So, wow. And you really didn't, I always feel like, oh, people must be, you know, they're trying to do that or they're working it.
I tagged my stuff with like hashtags, you know, embroidery. I don't know. Right. I think it's lots of people are. This is so niche. It's like it's just small enough of a universe of people that you can still be discovered in it. It's embroidery,
right?
But it's also large enough of an interest that people will follow you. Instagram is good for that. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in art, I like Instagram for its utility as a thing where it's all art.
That's what people say. That's what people say. I've yet to. Yeah. I don't like being advertised to, and yeah, I advertise a lot on that, and that bothers me.
It was better 4 years ago than it is now.
Well, I would say that about Facebook as well.
Yeah, so it kind of went viral. My son was just like, "Oh my God, how do you have so many followers? This is embarrassing. It's embroidery."
No, I think that's absolutely fantastic. I like that story. We can just end right there. No, that's fantastic. So how many images actually went into this one hoop?
365. I did one for every day. Somehow I managed to like space it. I started and I did it in a radial pattern. Mm-hmm. And so that I could kind of...
It goes out like a sun
yeah, like or? you would turn... No, like a sun, really. Mm-hmm. You could turn it in any direction and it would be correct. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, right
And center. What are some of the things that are in it?
Oh my God. There's everything from like Frida Kahlo to the feeling of an orgasm to like... or anger or there's a flamingo. There's political statements like the day that Trump was elected. I was working on it. It was 2016. And I wound up calling it We're All in This Together was the name of the title I came up with at the end of the year. So there were like, you know, immigrants and refugees welcome here. Those kind of like little signs and you name it. It's like...
But every piece of content was dictated by...
Every piece.
By the internet.
By the internet. Which... Okay. It kept me on it. as it grew, it got me excited to do it. It was sometimes a slog, like actually making time every single day to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, someone would say like strawberry and I'd be like, here's the world's tiniest strawberry. It's going to take me 5 minutes to do this because that's all I have time for today. But it was a really, really good demonstration to myself that I can actually follow through with something and I can make art into a daily practice.
The other thing is that by working, it forced you to do it every single day. So you got your, probably upped your game.
Oh my God. Yeah. I had just started embroidering like a year before.
Do you use the same stitches or?
No, I don't.
Do you use stitches?
Not really. Yeah. It's more of a, like,
I didn't see any more elaborate formal stitches.
I mean, I can do those stitches. I taught myself how to do them, but they're not conducive to the kind of almost drawing that I want to do
couching.
I do some couching. I do a lot of just satin stitch and just using thread is
satin stitch is just making straight lines to make a nice smooth surface.
But for the most part, I just kind of fill it in too. I use it sort of the same way you would a pencil line, like short little lines.
Right. Okay.
So Keb Mo had a agent of sorts. She was a woman who was hired to source the art. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure she was art director, but she sourced the material. So she called me out of the blue. She tracked down my phone number. I almost didn't answer it because who answers phone calls from out of state that they don't know anymore? And she asked me, they thought about using that image and then they thought about asking him for a list of elements that would be meaningful to him and the themes of this album. And so ultimately he gave me a list of objects that he wanted stitched. I think I wound up doing like 50. It took, I had a very short turnaround and it took a lot of every waking hour for a couple of weeks, maybe like 3 weeks where I just stitched maniacally to get through them all. And I sent them and they arranged them the way they wanted to. I kind of tried to make it so they would fit together, but that they could also piece them out. And so that's what they've wound up doing is they've used them on socks and mugs and you name it.
Okay, we'll go back to that in a second. I just want to say that you're listening to Live Culture. I'm your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis, and this is WPKN Bridgeport 89.5 FM and streaming online at WPKN.org. This month, I'm delighted to be talking with Michelle Beaulieu Morgan about her embroidery practice as an artist, and she is about to have an exhibit, but we're also talking about her current project, which is the Keb Mo album, which is just dropped, called Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And you did the cover art for it. And we were talking about the process of that. So what kinds of things was on the list? Did you ever actually talk to Keb?
I didn't. I talked to his wife a lot. She was the one who kind of acted as a go-between. She's lovely. And it was such a whirlwind, again, process. Like, it was like they contacted me. They sent me a list. He was on a plane, and he came up with a list. There's a dancing girl, like the emoji, the dancing girl emoji. There's a world. He wanted Straight Outta Compton, the sign.
Yeah.
So I did that. There's a couple of his guitars that were, like, actually his guitars. They sent me
special
photos.
Special guitars, right.
His dog, Rudy. I did, like, a little illustration of a recycle sign. I mean, just, like, things. A suitcase. He had me do the Tajmo, which is the title, like, logo that was on his last album with Taj Mahal.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, like, an embroidery version of that. I mean, it was just, like, a list of things.
So it is interesting the way that the internet has influenced your work, because what you're talking about is an awful lot like series of emojis.
Yeah. Iconography of sorts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So shorthand for something else and then putting it back into a handmade mode and these sort of little dots of meaning surrounding. So the cover album, to be clear, features him.
Right.
And then he's surrounded by these objects.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a kind of constellation around him.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. There is actually a constellation in there, too.
Because he likes constellations.
Yeah.
Any particular constellation?
I think it was, I can't remember, Orion, I think. I don't even remember what I did.
But you seem to be focusing on making unique, discrete items
that live together in a space rather than trying to put it together in sort of one woven narrative.
Well, it's funny because that's what I've gotten the most attention for, but it's not my preference as far as like, no, this is, it's like, I was really glad to have made that big year long piece. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It taught me a lot. It forced me to like make things that I otherwise would say, no, I don't know if I can do that. Mm-hmm. And so it really pushed me in that way. People really responded to it a lot. I would much rather do something abstract that's just like...
Right, because I could imagine something that was like a constellation, like a sky that had all of these different kinds of colors. Or
and
I don't know what.
I make all the time. I'm constantly, if you look at my Instagram, it's like there are very abstract pieces. You had mentioned like color or, as a segue into talking about the Kebmo piece and embroidery floss and fabrics and the medium itself. Like I love making pieces that are just basically like, how am I going to play with this color palette and mm-hmm. work these different textures that aren't even really stitches, but are different textures.
Surfaces,
that you, surfaces.
So I think color and surfaces are, you know, one of the real pleasures of art making. Mm-hmm. And it is, there is something really therapeutic about mm-hmm. working with color and putting colors
and together
and together, seeing them in relationship to each other.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and that, that's where I find the most joy in embroidering.
Right.
The last piece I did was all black, and I'm doing an all black piece now too, which is just, again, like pushing myself a little bit. Like, how can I play with texture and keep a monochromatic color scheme? But my impulse is definitely to just like more is more all the time.
Are you enjoying doing the monochromatic?
Or I just love the way it looks at the end. I love it.
Yeah.
When I'm done, the process itself is just like, why am I just using... I mean, I dress almost entirely in black, but like, you know.
Right, but that's different than what you might choose to make.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm not enjoying it, but I love how it looks at the end.
Yeah, so that's totally different. I mean, for instance, I always think... So, I don't want to ever do that. I always think if I can imagine what the painting or drawing or installation really looks like before I've even... darted it, mm-hmm. I could just sit there and imagine it. I don't need to make it.
Yeah.
I really don't. People say, do you see it in your head?
Yeah.
Well, sort of. I've got the set of qualities of what it is and what it is not, and that gets moved and played with by my brain as I go along.
Yeah.
And then by the end, it's something that I hopefully couldn't have mm-hmm. imagined exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I want. And so if I started off doing something and made it like an assignment, like I'm going to...
Yep.
I'm only going to use black and it's going to be on this frame and then...
So people ask me a lot too. They're like, do you have a pattern? I'm like, no, this, I'm just going along.
So you do it organically.
Totally. But the thing that I do think that I'm learning from the monochromatic piece is that it allows me to play with light in a way that I usually can't with embroidery.
Yeah.
It's like I'm choosing all one color floss, but they're different... you know, weights and different kinds of thread or yarn or string. And each one reflects light a little bit differently. And so it's really the first, and I'll put mm-hmm. beads and incorporate beads into it.
So you're going to get really fancy and glossy.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just, that is less of a, when I'm using color, I'm able to downplay the way light actually reflects off from thread because color moves forward.
It takes some of the dimension out of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And or I can just rely on the color to do the work mm-hmm. that I can't rely on it to do. And so it is, you know, I'm new enough at it that I'm like, I get bored pretty easily. I want to try new things and I'll, you know, do these sort of assignments. And I do like the way it's finishing. And I do think it ultimately will help me think about the way fabric can actually reflect light.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I don't know. No, I don't have a plan.
That's good.
That's for sure.
That's good. You seem to like rules and...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you seem very rule-based. So, you know, when you look at paintings by Robert Ryman, who died recently, who painted all white paintings. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen any of them. They reproduce horribly, so you have to actually look at them.
Yeah.
And the other person that I think of is Louise Nevelson, who...
People
of course,
say they think I'm Louise Nevelson. Yeah. Like, it reminds them of Louise Nevelson all the time.
But, right, because that's exactly what it does, painting the surfaces and then putting them in the boxes like that. Working in monochrome makes you have to pay attention to the dynamics of space
a little bit,
differently. And they can be totally mesmerizing, but the person needs to have the attention span to actually focus in on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, although adding beads and furry textures and things, I think, would help.
It's true. I also have done a series that will be in the show that was a little bit off
the charts for me as far as subject matter, which is they're just a series of hoops that I'm really interested in red work as a, like quilting and an embroidery and a textile history of red work, which is just using red and white for the most part. And
where does that come from? What culture?
I think it was probably English at some point, but I'm interested in, at least in the US, it's been like, it was a tradition in the 19th century and still is a tradition in quilting.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like folksy, you know, home, down home, crafty.
Dutch.
Yeah. That kind of like sense to it. But I did a bunch of hoops over and over and over again, where I was just using red thread to make like cross sections of trees.
Mm-hmm.
So they look like, you know, tree rings.
Cut tree rings. Were you making portraits of actual tree rings?
No, definitely not, because I don't have that much of an attention span.
Okay.
I just wanted them to look like trees. I mean, it would be cool to do an actual portrait of a tree. I did not have a
portrait. Well, given your other project, which was a way of kind of gathering data and could be seen as a calendar marking time, I can see you doing an actual tree ring project.
Yeah, and I wouldn't put it past me. This was, but again, Louise Nevelson, I didn't even realize at the time, had done these series of red hoops and like circles that later in her life that people were like, oh, this looks like that. And it's not the first time that compared. So
interesting.
That was cool. That was more of
a huge scale shift between you and Louise Nevelson. You're the miniature Louise Nevelson.
Right. I'm not putting myself in the category of Louise Nevelson. The impulse, I think.
Why not?
Is somewhat,
I love Louise Nevelson.
Oh, no. I think she's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just suffering from my own insecurities about whether or not you can call yourself an artist if you have a day job. But
so I was going to ask you about art and craft. And I was talking with a friend of mine who does something that is both art and craft.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how it had to be something that was reproducible. So accident and chance play a big part in contemporary art, and playing with accident and chance, the things that you cannot control.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, according to him, craft had to have the skill to, even if you're dealing with something with that creates chance, like raku firing, for instance, you want to be able to get it so that you can quasi-predictably play with that and get...
If I can solve, during this interview, the line between art and craft, then
I'm not sure I care that much. I mean, for me, a lot of contemporary craft is uninteresting, for me personally, because it's focused on skill and virtuosic skill rather than content.
Yeah.
Whereas quite a lot of the art that I really like, you know, it's odd because I did go to art school and they focused a lot on building up a set of skills.
Yeah.
And I have a set of skills, but great art is not necessarily made with the skill set. It really has to do with something else.
Yeah.
And the content is missing a lot of times for me. Or it's done in a kind of too illustrational way.
So I try to, and this is a whole other debate that I'm entering, but I tend to think of my stuff more as folk art than either art or craft. And then folk
art
itself is
its own.
Are you just
making your life easy?
I am just making my life easy. It's a whole other contentious category of what folk art even means and why folk. And I think,
does it mean self-taught or passed on a tradition of skills that are passed on?
It's as much material as anything, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe untaught a little bit, like self-taught and material-based. Like, am I making...
Or handed down rather than, say, self-taught.
Yes,
like,
yes, yeah.
Like,
embroidery is very much a tradition that's handed down through generations. And so I think of it as in those terms. But I wouldn't call what I do craft, because I know craft embroidery when I see it, and I have I think I do, and I think, well, that's, you know, people who are planning scripted words out and they're doing them in brick stitch, which looks a particular way, and it's something that, like, you could send a pattern out and someone could reproduce it. So I think, like, that element again of it being unpredictable and things happening get removed from craft. What I do, though, I'm like, it has something to do with scale for me with art too. Mm-hmm. I think if I had more, I feel torn between, like, my sort of, I use the word maniacal a lot. This will be the third time I've said it in this interview. Like, I just have to keep producing. Like, if I don't, then I get anxious. So for me,
that is the therapeutic.
It's therapeutic. And so I could spend a lot more time on one piece, and it could be more intricate, and it could be more it could take more time and maybe it would, like, you know, stratospherically be whatever into the realm of art instead of craft. But I also just have to keep producing. It's, yeah, it's a, like, compulsive problem for me.
There's really craft that is better than lots of things that call themselves art.
Exactly.
Like, I don't actually care about the differentiation between the two things, and there is art to both of them, and there's craft to both of them. So whether something's a painting or a bowl, and a lot of craft objects have a start out with a useful function. It may deviate from there. But one of the things that I was going to say, that as I was thinking it, I was also thinking, but that's so not true. but the idea that it's more about that art traditionally focuses on the process rather than knowing what the outcome and trying to make a predictable, good-looking outcome. Yeah. But that's absolutely not true, because there's tons of, you know, and any, you know, before the 20th century, any kind of commissioned artist was very much concerned with, what, you know, how glossy and shiny and perfect.
Advanced sketches of, you know, pre-working.
And it has to actually have that. So even as I was thinking it, I was thinking, but for somebody who's interested in sort of a more personal and therapeutic approach, the process is the part
that's
important.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Stuart Davis said neatness doesn't count in art.
Oh, that's a part of it too. So so in the embroidery world on Instagram, at least, and my sense is that this is true outside of the little world of Instagram as well. But like, there is definitely a like neatness factor. Like, how meticulous is this person with their embroidery, and what do the backs look like, and like. And to me, that's just so boring. Like, I don't care about that at all.
Well,
like, I think it's more important to me that my works don't look perfect and that I'm not trying to achieve some kind of, like, really, I don't know. That to me is boring. That's boring. It's like a technical skill that and virtuosity that I'm not really interested
in. And you seem to be much more on the expressionistic end of things. And you're using it like drawing. So you're using these very simple lines and stitches.
Right.
It's not complicated. You can see looking at it.
And it's why the illustrated pieces like the Kemo album, like, people like that, but I find it less process, like, it's less satisfying to me than just kind of going at a canvas or fabric hoop.
Well, it has a nice kind of, like drawing and sketching, it has a nice kind of immediacy to it, and it also gives it that textured immediacy. So something that would be kind of more glossy and more finished might look too much like real emojis or real recycling symbols. Like, who wants an airbrushed recycling symbol floating around them? But it's sort of sketched out one.
Yeah. It's not handmade, and it's unexpected, I guess, in some way.
So it emphasizes the handmade part.
Yeah.
So you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and streaming online at WPKN.org from beautiful Bridgeport, Connecticut. I am Martha Willette Lewis, and this is Live Culture, and I'm talking with Michelle Beaulieu Morgan. I have so much trouble saying
it's
your
name. It's great.
I have to look
every time you say my name, I feel so validated because you actually say Michelle, which is what my mother intended it to be, which nobody ever says,
what
including
they say?
Myself. Michelle.
Michelle, okay.
Yeah, and you say Michelle, and I love it.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's up?
And so let's talk more about the exhibit, Material Obsessions. Is this the first time you've had an art exhibit?
I've been in lots of shows over the years, pieces, but I've never had a solo exhibit. So this is my first, like, actual solo exhibition.
And is it your first exhibition showing the embroidered pieces, or
I've been in a couple of things. Last year, there was randomly, again, through the internet, there was a show with three embroidery artists, me and two others, in Allentown, Pennsylvania, that was up there, and that was really cool, actually. It was really, really neat. It was the first time people don't have embroidery shows very often. There's like Stitch Fetish in LA every year that happens, and that's a big show. But that's all like fetish, like work that takes up fetish pretty much, you know, sexual themes and fetish as subject matter. And I don't really work in that much. So with those themes, I do, but not explicitly.
Speaking of niche market.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of textile exhibits, though, and then because you make work that are about things that aren't necessarily just about embroidery, you could be in all kinds of
exhibits. Oh, yeah. I think I'm new, too, you know? Like, again, this is, like, I've been doing this for just a couple of years, really, and I sell stuff really fast. Like, so I'll sell stuff on Instagram. Like, people will buy stuff from me very quickly, and so I rarely have, like, it's been really hard.
You have a stock of things.
It was very difficult for me.
That is a problem that not many artists have.
They're small.
I don't have that
They're
problem.
Small.
I have a great
They're
museum
small.
Of me. They're small. So they sell for a reasonable amount.
They're more, I think that I'm reasonable. I try not to undersell myself, and I try not to undersell other artists. And I know that that is like
a huge issue.
But because I can kind of go through things, I think that I just have the market price where it's like, I usually sell things from $75 to like $300. And it's just that market point where people can afford to buy something and anything. And it seems reasonable for the amount of time I'm spending on it personally. So I do have a hard time keeping things. This show is like, it's making me a little anxious actually, because there's momentum that happens with stuff too. And then once you have it and it's not sold, it takes a little bit longer. But
are you making things specifically for the show?
I was, yeah.
And that you won't be showing on Instagram?
Everything's on Instagram.
Do you ever get injured? You were talking about trying to do all of the Kebmo stitching, and I've done sort of obsessive knitting where I've actually managed to give my hands like some carpal tunnel. Some issues.
Yeah, I have a wrist issue. Mm-hmm. I have a thumb issue on my left hand from holding the hoop. If you hold it in the certain and one, you know, and you're stitching, but it tends to be as bad as I thought it would be. I also have a limited amount of time that I can,
that's probably a good thing.
It's a good thing. I have a 9-to-5. I go to work every day, Monday through Friday. And then the time that I have to stitch is the time I have to stitch. And if I had full reign to stitch all day, every day, I probably would. And it would be worse.
Yeah. Lots of artists who are in museums who you know and admire had day jobs.
Yes, right. I know.
And every artist has several jobs.
Yes,
because
of course.
At this point,
right.
None of us can survive.
Who makes money as a poet, right?
Right. At this point in time, I think you can just assume that we all have other jobs. We dream about the other part of our life. So for Material Obsessions, which is a great name, are you doing anything different? Are you making still the same size hoops? Conceptually, what's going to be there, and how is it going to be hung?
I tend to work in I have several series. So there are some that are like really abstract. I have the tree ring series alongside a bunch of other pieces I've done that are red work or all done in red and white. And so those will be grouped together. But conceptually, it's really more each series that will be hung together. There's a hallway and then there's a large room. It's not an ideal setting, but it'll work. Each of those series really takes up issues of recovery, and mostly recovery. I think of everything that I've done is always about recovery. So I'm an alcoholic and I'm pretty vocal about that. I quit drinking pretty much the same time I took up embroidery.
Interesting.
So it was just over 4 years ago that I quit drinking. And so when I say embroidery saved me and it really helped me pull me out of the depression, quitting drinking also really helped.
Yes.
For those of you up there who are wondering whether or
it
not
is a
drinking.
It's a depressant.
Well, quitting drinking will help with your depression. I almost guarantee you it will help. But I've always, everything I've made has just kind of felt like it was me coming to terms with all of those addictions, whether it is compulsive behavior around school and reading and thinking, if it's drinking. I chain smoked for 20 years. I started smoking when I was 12 years old. You know, people who have those kinds of...
You like your routines.
I like my routines and I like my rules. And if I don't live by my rules, then I'm buying myself in trouble.
Yeah. So does that have something to do with the circular hoop? You started to say something about that, and I wanted to also ask you about what kinds of hoops, because there are plastic ones and wooden ones, and I bet you have preferences.
I do have preferences. My preference is always for the vintage hoops that you buy lots of off from people on eBay. The metal ones are really cool. And they don't make them anymore.
They don't make metal hoops?
They maybe make them, but
they're
I don't see them. They're so much better at gripping.
I don't have any anymore.
I love just the look of the older wooden hoops. Most of the hoops now that you're going to buy are like bamboo or plastic, and they're ugly, and I don't like them. So I really do prefer old hoops. The circular, it gets back to the conversation around like art and craft. And so I really think of it as a gendered issue. Like when you take something and you keep it in the hoop, and that is a natural frame. It's a frame, but it signifies as craft. Whereas if I were to like take the fabric and the piece out of the hoop and then frame it in a circular wooden frame, it would somehow, you know, be art in a way that the hoop signifies, you know, craft. So,
so a frame is an automatic signifier
of something of like, that's art.
And that always seems like a real sort of rookie move to me, is that when people start out making paintings, first of all, they try to make oil paintings, and second of all, they have it in a gold frame afterwards. And that's so that everybody knows that it's art.
This is art, you know,
Like it's art with a capital A.
Yeah. And so I also an expense issue. It's like a class issue. I mean, you can keep something in a frame or in a hoop and it's cheap and you can hang it on the wall just like it is. But it's also gendered to me. Like, I really love thinking about why embroidery and the traditions of embroidery have been considered women's art and women's work, and what the embroidery hoop does with that. And I've contemplated a few times, like, taking the hoop and then framing the hoop, and I'm like, that's kind of schlocky. Like, you know, I don't know. It's a little too over heavy-handed with the, like, no, this is art, even though it's still in a hoop.
Although you might want them under glass.
Yeah.
At some point. Do you trim the fabric around the edge?
I usually pull it back on the back and secure
so
it.
It up.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
So you do some arty things to it. It's not
No, it's not completely in the raw.
Yeah.
And sometimes I take them out. There are pieces that I've framed just because they weren't meant to be circular. Like, they were pieces that should be under glass. Someone just bought a piece last year that was pretty large, and it had no business staying in a hoop. It was like an oval shape, and it needed to be under glass.
Do you work on cotton only? What kinds of textiles? What's the textile?
I recycle a lot of stuff. I'll have a pair of pants, and I'll cut them up. Vinyl. I love working on vinyl. I think it's just like fake leather, all that kind of stuff. You name it, I'll work on it. I tend not to work on anything that's too flimsy or ethereal. You'll see people who do these beautiful pieces on like tulle, and it's the back has to be perfect because you can see everything through it. I'm not that neat.
As a child, I was taken to an exhibit at the Science Museum. It was Chinese craft artisans.
Oh, yeah.
And there was somebody doing embroidery on something that was beyond ethereal. Like, it almost wasn't there. And it was double-sided.
Yeah.
It was perfectly double-sided. It was astonishing. It was even as I was looking at it, I couldn't believe it.
And there are people who do that. That is a whole tradition. A lot of Chinese embroidery, that's
so
the goal.
It's perfect.
And something else. But
do you embroider on clothing and wearable things? Because it seems like a natural extension.
So I did do a vest once. I had a denim vest that didn't fit me, and I embroidered on it, and I really loved it. And people have reached out to me, and usually when people ask me to embroider on their clothes, I'll do it for them.
But it's nothing that, because so you've got it flat in the frame. But at a certain point with sewing and knitting and all these other things,
you got to take it out.
I'm wondering whether I'm pushing a personal preference on you. So I get really interested in making things that structurally go into three dimensions. And then the idea of something that's wearable and that interacts with the body is also quite appealing. I'm interested in clothes and what clothes say also.
Yeah.
But certainly with knitting, I immediately got interested in going from knitting just a flat thing to being able to knit a tube to being able to knit actual structural things, sculptural things.
I think I would love to have more of that work and to do more of that work. I just haven't yet. I have done some, like I said, clothes. My fantasy life involves me throwing away my entire life as we know it and moving to London to go to the Royal School of Needlework and then doing like fashion embroidery for like
working in the haute couture industry. You'd hate it. They only want things to be perfect. You'd have to use other people's designs.
I would want to like these like headdresses and like veils and capes and like all these other like things that could be done. Like that appeals to me, but again,
it's so antithetical to what you actually do that it's really
it's never gonna happen. It's fine.
And the other thing is that you've made something. The hoop is a handheld device, and it's portable. You're using very large hoops, which most of the time I don't think you are.
No, but I did carry around that large hoop every day for a year, even though I promised my wife I would not carry around the large hoop for a year.
But you did it anyway. So the minute you start making things that are sculptural, you have storage issues, but also it's not portable. You can't just do it at a bus stop or and one of the reasons that I loved doing knitting and I love doing embroidery is you can kind of take it with you.
Absolutely. Right? It is really portable, and I especially in the beginning, that was probably the biggest thing, because in the beginning I was sitting in a lot of AA meetings and I was embroidering through them, and it was, you know,
it's great for meetings.
So that just became my habit, you know. And again, I think I'm still discovering what it is that I want to do with it, mm-hmm. enough so that I am still in the habit of just having that hoop. And I do take it with me everywhere, less so than I used to. When I first started, it was like, you wouldn't catch me without a hoop in my hand. I would be doing it right now while we're talking.
Right, but... right. No, it's a sort of a security blanket, yes. in a certain yeah. way.
Yep.
It's a fidget device.
Yes.
For the exhibit, for Material Obsessions, let's give people some dates. It's going to open up around September 10th, but the actual opening is not until September 17th.
Yes, there's going to be a gallery opening. I believe that will be around 6 p.m. at the Whitney Humanity Center, which is on Wall Street in mm-hmm. New Haven.
And then it goes until early December. And there's the website is whc.yale.edu. And if you look for the gallery at the Whitney, you can find out all kinds of information. And presumably there'll be some pictures.
Yes, there will be pictures. And my artist statement's going up there. It should be up by the time this airs, I believe. So.
Okay. And on Instagram, you're at Mutually Assured Deconstruction.
Yes.
Which is one. long, nerdy sentence
grad
there.
Student
yeah. Is all of the work done for Material Obsession? Are you making things to sort of specifically go together?
I was,
for the exhibit?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I definitely, 2 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. So I have made things all along the past couple of years that I've been like, well, this will be in the show, this will be in the show, this will be in the show.
How do you, and what things get to make it into the show?
Whether or not I think it's good enough.
Yeah.
You know, there's things that I'm like, absolutely not. This was me playing and...
Right.
You know.
It was a failed experiment.
It was a failed experiment.
Will you sell a failed experiment?
No. Yeah, I mean, someone wants to buy it, I guess.
Well, it's
feel good about
Instagram,
it.
Though.
Right.
Do you put it up regardless?
I do, actually, yeah. I think it's really, really important that there's so much, especially with something like this, that can be, like, technically virtuosic or any mm-hmm. art form. But there's so much of that. People will really be like, look at how perfect this is. And I'm like, no. People write in, ask me all the time for advice on beginning. And I'm like, find something you like and copy it. And I know that's a big no-no, but you're not going to learn if you don't copy.
Oh, copying
like,
is
you
really...
have to. Yeah. You've got to, that's how you're going to learn how
and
to
learn
do anything.
From, copy from the best, yeah. you know. Draw from Van Gogh drawings,
right? That's
like,
what
don't...
you do. You imitate before you can, you know.
But also, so. It puts you in the mindset mm-hmm. of the artist.
Yeah.
You learn so much from
yeah.
it.
And I think it's important that people see your failures too. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to.
So that's interesting. I'm really interested in the way that social media and the internet work with your career. I learned how to knit not from my mother or my grandmother, both of whom knitted. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was British and so knit using a completely different way than most people do in the United States. And my mother was left-handed and my grandmother was ambidextrous. So the two of them trying to teach me was more or less useless.
Yeah.
I learned from a book and then I immediately started looking on the internet and there's Ravelry, which is an entire, it's like Facebook, but for people
knitting.
For knitting.
Yeah.
I know people love it. I got bored of it. Mm-hmm. There's so much. I actually found the saturation of the internet. But at first, it was amazing. I could find patterns, and mm-hmm. there were chat groups, and you could learn about anything. Mm-hmm. And I submitted patterns and got them, you know, published.
Yeah.
So... embroidery presumably has a similar
there is. I don't really, people ask me a lot, like, do you do videos? Do you
tutorials?
And I'm like, no, I don't have any interest in doing them. And if I really want to know how to do a stitch, I'll, you know, go on YouTube and find some Nana, you know, who's showing people how to do these traditional stitches. And that's
right.
fine. But it's just not where I'm at with it. I don't really follow that sort of...
I find watching videos really boring as an instructional.
Yeah.
I'd much rather read a set of instructions.
And so much of this is me not... I'm not following any, like, traditional embroidery rules. My medium happens to be embroidery or what people think of as embroidery because I'm using thread and hoops and those tools. But I'm not using traditional stitches and... for the most part, so.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that you're selling your work on...
As
embroidery. You're getting sort of crowdsourced information to make the embroidery. It's kind of your arena rather than having exhibits. So it is kind of fascinating the way that these things have interfaced.
It is weird. I don't like social media, and yet somehow it's worked for me on this. I think I was in the right place at the right time as far as that goes. It's going to fall apart. Instagram is not going to be forever. And then, you know, I'm still going to have what I want to make and do what I want to do regardless. But
Do you make things differently because of that?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Nope.
So the whole sort of emoji or discrete object.
I'm interested in emojis as icons. Like in the beginning, emojis were meant to symbolize like a plethora of things. They weren't supposed to be discrete one-for-one objects where this emoji signifies this particular thing, right?
Which just seems like a boring...
Right. And that's the way emojis have gone. Now we have emojis for everything instead of having to be inventive about the way we use them to as a stand-in for language. They are their own, like, say it. Iconographs? That's not the right word.
Iconography?
They're their own iconography. Their own icons, I guess.
Mm-hmm. They are icons.
They are icons, right. So that has shifted even in 4 years. Like 4 years ago, the way you would use a smiley face is there. Now there's 50 smiley faces so that you know exactly what kind of smiley face we're talking about. And the sort of influence on my own practice, I'm not usually going to embroider that unless somebody asks for it. Like when it's, you know, that's what other people maybe are relating to. But as far as my own practice, I don't know. Of course, I'm influenced by other embroidery artists in the internet world of them. But at the same time, I really don't necessarily feel like I'm doing the same thing as other people.
And how do you photograph your work? Instagram means that some things look really great and some things don't. And presumably you've gotten a lot better at sort of lighting, magically making things. Are you not using beauty filters?
I use no filters. No filters on my Instagram. I want them to be at least, you know, a picture of the thing that I made and not a picture of the thing I made filtered through something that changes it into something else. I have a spot on my bed where the light at night, if I put the light on it, mm-hmm. takes good photographs. I will use the video a lot and then screen capture it. The video
That's
on my camera works a lot better than the camera. So if I video it and then I take a screen capture, it tends to be a way better quality and I can just use that than if I actually try to use the camera. But no, I have no professional photography skills whatsoever, nor do I have like a really good setup for it. I'll wait to post something if it's like today, rainy and cool. I can't get a good picture. I'll wait until there's more better natural light than something like this.
So we're going to have to wrap things up.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask a little bit, going back to Keb Mo, there's an enormous store, and you started to mention it, and then we...
Yes.
Yeah, so there's an enormous store of things that one can buy that now have images of your things on it, including other textile things like socks.
Socks, printed just, with...
Tell me about this.
I keep running across things where it is so like absolutely postmodern. I'm like, well, this is meta on meta on meta.
It is very weird.
So the my favorite part of this is there's this little arrow that I have tattooed on me that I then embroidered, which is now like on all of these different things. And my wife has this. This is like our, you know,
this is what you get for putting your personal symbols on somebody else's.
So now my personal symbol is like, you know, our little cute tattoo is all over the internet, but via flesh, via embroidery, via digital. It's weird to see stuff like that. I've never sold anything that was then licensed basically for reproduction like that. And
what kinds of things do they have?
They have socks. They have the record, the vinyl.
They had elaborate tiger's eye vinyl.
Yes. And then the mat itself that goes on a turntable.
Mm-hmm.
Mugs. They have sweatshirts. They have, oh my gosh, t-shirt, water bottles. There's pins.
These are things I can't even imagine buying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not because the artwork isn't lovely on them, but...
It's branded for Keb Mo, so people are buying it because it's Keb Mo. It's, you know...
But that's what I mean. That's what I can't imagine.
I'll buy t-shirts for bands. I'll do a lot of that. I'll buy t-shirts for bands. And I buy a lot of vinyl, and it'll come with, like, a fanny pack, you know, that's been...
I suppose if it came with something, I would... Yeah. Yeah. The idea of buying...
A bundle of things.
Keb Mo water bottle just seems... I'm having a hard time understanding one. Even if it's really nice looking, it still would be
t-shirts for bands, but I don't buy a lot of other merch, but apparently, you know, I guess.
Well, I think the other thing is that there's an explosion in what you can make.
Yes.
And that may be it. They may be testing it out and they may not have warehouses.
Oh yeah. No,
stuff.
They don't.
They're probably making it on demand. So they're kind of seeing.
Although I kind of want socks. I'm like,
the socks
thinking about
really
writing
good.
To them and be like, can you send me some socks?
I think you deserve some socks.
Right?
And also there's something really lovely about the fact that you've embroidered a textile,
and then they photographed it into the album,
and then they've taken that and transposed it further, and then sent it to some factory to make socks out of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my son was like, "I hope you're getting a cut of all this," and I'm like, "You're hilarious."
Yeah,
like,
you're hilarious.
But
it's been delightful talking to you. I've been talking to Michelle Beaulieu Morgan.
Good job.
Who is having an exhibit, Material Obsessions, will open. Well, it opens on September 17th. It's actually, the exhibit is up September 10th, and it goes through early December at the Whitney Humanities Center in New Haven. And whc.yale.edu, and you look for the gallery at the Whitney Humanities Center. The show has been 2 years in the making, and it will feature her embroidery. And you can also see her embroidery on Kebmo's latest album, Oklahoma.
Yep.
And, of course, look at the merchandise site. And apparently, if one goes to your Instagram site, you can see this piece that is the calendar of an entire year and everything else that you ever made. So thank you for being on Live Culture.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Junior from Memphis, Tennessee. My daddy was a hustler and a stranger to me. I don't always know just what to say. Now listen. Do I look familiar in any kind of way? Will I remember you? On the floor, I remember you walking out the door. You had a red dress on and some high heel shoes. You don't remember me, but I remember. Remember you dancing on the floor.
Support comes from the Green River Festival in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Taking place from July 12th through 14th, the festival showcases over 30 bands across three stages. There will be music, local food, beer and wine, a handmade craft fair, and family games and activities. This year's lineup includes Lucinda Williams, The Wood Brothers, Anjali Kijo, Rhiannon Giddens, and many more. Children under 10 are free and able to attend children's music performances, art activities tents, circus acts, and a Mardi Gras parade. More information can be found at greenriverfestival.com.
When I was a young boy.
Hey, this is Alec Cumming from the show Snap Crackle Pop. Today at 4 p.m., I'm going to be playing you a special interview and career retrospective of sorts for the legendary singer-songwriter Reckless Eric. He first became known in the mid to late 1970s in the stiff records punk rock scene of London, but I think he's making some of the best music of his life right now. We'll be playing some music from his new album, Transients. So join me for my interview with Reckless Eric today at 4 p.m. right here only on WPKN.
WPKN is seeking to hire an underwriting representative for the station. If you are interested in applying for this position, please visit the WPKN website at WPKN.org and then click on the job listings link for further information.
Hi, this is Casey Ryan. I've been a WPKN listener, volunteer, and sometimes even a programmer for almost 30 years. Yeah, I really do love this quirky little radio station. which is why for several years now I've also been a sustaining supporter. Each month, I automatically contribute an amount I chose, an amount I hardly miss, but that really helps when it comes to paying WPKN's bills. Every time I listen to WPKN and I hear that reminder about it being listener-supported, I think, hey, I'm one of those listeners who are supporting it. Yay me! Now I'm asking you to consider joining me. Just go to our website, WPKN.org, and tap the donate button. It's a simple process to become a monthly sustaining WPKN supporter. And trust me, it feels so good to be one.
Hi, I'm Terry Smith, Creative Director at Franklin Streetworks. We're a nonprofit contemporary art space and cafe in Stamford, Connecticut. We curate three group exhibitions each year, and many address social issues such as immigrant rights, LGBTQ themes, and the environment. We have shown more than 350 artists from around the world, including many emerging artists who have gone on to show at major museums such as the Whitney Museum of American Art. Our exhibitions and educational programming are free and open to the public. More information is at our website, franklinstreetworks.org, or on our Facebook page.
This is Ralph Nader inviting you to listen to my weekly radio program, The Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Sundays at 6 p.m., right here on WPKN Radio. Please join me for a lively hour of interviews with some of the nation's most influential movers and shakers that you never see here on mass media, every Sunday on listener-supported. Listener supported.